sprouted bread slathered with butter. Many of the best athletes and performers feel the same way. And like me, they know that all bread is not created equal, which we learned in Chapter 8 when we discussed how sprouting and fermenting alleviate some of the common anti-nutrients found in bread. But not all times during the day are right for bread. The best timing for bread is dinner, after your glycogen stores have been depleted by exercise and you're about to head into the winter of your day, sleep. So if bread and butter is your thing, do it the right way, with grass-fed butter on sprouted or sourdough. Go for it. Chocolate is a perfect example of a really good thing that we found a way to fuck up. Cacao is a true superfood, packed with antioxidants shown to be more effective than blueberries or acai, along with a few really cool psychoactive compounds like caffeine and theobromine that boost mood and cognition. Cacao even has protein and fiber, and its byproduct, cacao butter, is one of the best natural fats in the world. It is packed with minerals and even boosts nitric oxide production, giving chocolate its legendary aphrodisiac status. If you're talking about gifts from the gods, you have to include chocolate in that conversation. The Aztecs and Mayans did. Chocolate was sacred to them. You also have to recognize that modern food manufacturing has turned chocolate from a superfood into just another Trojan horse for pasteurized milk and sugar. Which means you have to know what you're buying when you're on the hunt for a chocolate treat. Fortunately, the world is waking up to this problem and acquiring a taste for chocolate as it was meant to be. Using natural sweeteners like stevia or monk fruit, brands like Lily's and Lakanto are offering dark chocolate without any added sugar and minimal dairy. Chocolate is a heart-healthy food, and we should treat it as such. Popcorn is one of those foods that if you're like me, you had no idea how the hell it even works. Popcorn is a type of corn kernel with a small amount of water in the center. When heated, the water expands into gas and the kernel explodes. Yay! Even though it's fluffy and white, there are actually quite a few important minerals in popcorn, including much-needed magnesium along with iron and zinc. To do it right, pop it yourself and add your own grass-fed butter and sea salt. Most store-bought popcorn contains the high omega-6 vegetable oils we warned about in Chapter 8. But the big reason to eat popcorn and dispense with the fiction that it's a secret indulgence to be enjoyed in the dark of a movie theater is the whopping 15 grams of insoluble fiber that come with it, which is extremely high. It's why my fiancé dubbed popcorn poo corn. Insoluble fiber like that found in popcorn is great for those legendary belly-flattening poops that provide a unique window into the importance of digestion, not just for health, but to start the morrow off right, with a big old deuce. Universal Nutrition Principle Number 7. What you think about food matters. I once had a very well-meaning and zealous employee who took it upon herself to advise all of our team members to do skin allergy tests. The push started innocently enough, but pretty soon everyone in the company was allergic to common, everyday healthy food. At our weekly birthday lunches, people who would normally be first in line to house some celebratory tacos or Texas barbecue would sit there staring longingly at food they had not thought twice about eating their entire lives, but now had determined they couldn't even touch. All because of a skin test. And this is true for everything. I can't tell you how many people in the wellness industry became wildly intolerant of wheat after reading a book like Wheat Belly. Some of these people are Italian and grew up on bread and pasta without a care in the world. But after that book, one ziti will send them running to the toilet. Their bodies didn't change at all when they received the information that ninjas were lurking in the wheat germ ready to slit their throat. Their minds changed. And when their minds changed, their bodies changed. This is not woo-woo, this is science. The famous nocebo effect, the evil twin of the placebo effect. Like when people were told that taking a pill with nothing in it would make them run slower, and it did. And it's the most overlooked aspect of nutrition, one that to own the day, you have to master. There's a great study where a researcher had two groups drink the same 300-calorie French vanilla shake. Ice cream. She made one group think they were drinking an indulgence shake, with higher calories and more sugar, like one you would drink from an old-timey diner. She led the other group to believe that they were drinking something more sensible with fewer calories, like something you would drink at a bougie health spa. Lo and behold, just telling these two groups that they were drinking different kinds of shakes changed their body's responses to it. The spa group demonstrated a stable hormone response, whereas the diner group had wild hormone swings, about 3 times as high as the other group. Their bodies had been tricked by their own minds. Not unlike with training results, this is the power of our own thoughts when it comes to food we put into our systems. And yet food allergy testing has never been more popular. It has become a cottage industry, a cottage full of problems. The biggest one is that everyone who gets one of these tests ends up seeming allergic to pretty much everything. Here's the issue with that. They are testing your skin, not your gut. Your skin cannot mimic the probiotic environment of your actual gut, so it results in a lot of false positives. Plus, they aren't always testing the difference between raw foods, cooked foods, and fermented types of the same food, which can be vast. But most important, they aren't taking the mind into consideration. Take Timmy. He is one of a dozen personalities in a man with multiple personality disorder. Timmy loves orange juice and drinks it frequently. However, if any one of his other personalities drinks that orange juice, he becomes wildly allergic, like hospital allergic. By simply changing the personality in control of his body, he changes whether or not OJ sends him to the hospital. Timmy's story was profiled in the New York Times all the way back in 1998 and shed some light on just how far the mind can go when it comes to controlling the body. If we tell our body something is poison, it becomes more poisonous. If we convince ourselves that it is healthy, it becomes more healthy. That is not to say that the reality of a food or situation doesn't matter. Molecular biology still exists. It's a real thing. But the mind isn't a passive bystander. It matters too. It can be part of the celebration that dinner is about to become, or it can become the ultimate party pooper that makes dinner a shit show. Universal Nutrition Principle Number 8. Nutrition is only as good as digestion. It is as true for any meal as it is for dinner that the nutritional value of your food is only as good as your body's ability to digest it. We are talking about it here, though, because our goal by the end of the chapter is to set you up with the ultimate pro-sex meal. And the only way that pays off is if you've primed your system to digest the foods of which that meal is comprised, and you aren't a bloated, tired, farting mess as a result. In addition, at the end of this section, we're going to talk about how to give you the right kind of gas, nitric oxide, which will help fuel you in any kind of performance, sexual, physical, or if you're doing it right, both. Eat slow, chew hard. There is an old saying, attributed somewhat curiously to Mahatma Gandhi, that to be healthy you must chew your drink and drink your food. While the Soylent guys may have taken that mantra a little too literally, what Gandhi is alluding to is the same reprimand that we've all received from at least one of our parents or relatives at some point in our childhoods. Slow down and chew your food. Most of the time they're chiding us because it looks sloppy or the sound of piglets at the dinner trough gets to them, or they're just worried we're going to choke. At least that's why we think they do it. They never really explain themselves. It turns out, though, that there is a very good reason to slow down and chew your food, even if our relatives didn't know it. Chewing is the process that first starts the breakdown of big pieces of food into little pieces. The mastication of the teeth, aka chewing, offers support in physically grinding the food, breaking it down. Saliva then picks up where chewing leaves off and makes food even smaller. Remember, all food eventually has to break down into super small particles if it's to be absorbed through the walls of your intestines and nourish the body. If you don't start in your mouth, your stomach and guts are going to have to work overtime, costing you vital energy and efficiency, and wasting some perfectly good food in the process. Have you ever gotten up from the toilet after a bowel movement and inspected your work? Of course you have. Every guy has, and I'm betting some of you ladies get in on the action too. Have you ever been able to tell, by its contents, exactly what you ate a few hours earlier? Maybe some corn kernels, some threads of spinach, some almond slivers or carrot chunks. If you can see it, it means you didn't digest it, which usually means you ate too fast. But what if you're like me and you suck at chewing? When I am stressed, I eat really fast, like a wolf devouring a freshly killed meal, which prevents me from chewing properly. I had a friend who prided himself, stress or no stress, on eating his meals as fast as his three dogs. Breaking news, he also consistently complained about intestinal pains. The other problem with eating fast is that your body doesn't have time to send up the signal that you are full as the food rockets down your throat like kids on a water slide. No surprise then that overeating is a big problem with fast eaters. Study after study shows that non-chewers and fast eaters are in a constant struggle with weight. One found that fast eaters are up to 115% more likely to be obese. Another study of 4,000 people showed that those who ate very fast tended to be heavier and had gained the most body weight since age 20. Put simply, overweight people chew less than normal weight people because when you chew more, you tend to eat less, 15% less in one study that used delicious pizza for its experiment. One of the ways to give you more time to chew your food, and therefore eat slower and eat less, is to take smaller bites, using less efficient tools. Have you ever seen an eating competition that used chopsticks or cocktail forks? Of course not. That would only slow these animals down. That's why I force myself to eat with the most inefficient tools possible, to let my mouth start the process of making my digestion as efficient as possible. So buy yourself some extra chopsticks and then try to eat your damn Cheerios. Stomach acid. Keep the fire hot. If you've ever watched a movie about Mexican drug cartels, you've probably seen how effective acid can be in disintegrating organic matter. Well, what works with bodies in 55-gallon drums works just as well for food in the human stomach. Once you've swallowed your well-chewed food, it is principally hydrochloric acid, HCl, in your stomach that takes the food from small to microscopic. To make sure that process works as effectively as possible, you need to keep up your HCl levels. One of the most common digestive mistakes people make is consuming cold beverages while they eat. Any beverage dilutes the HCl in your stomach, making the overall acid concentration acting on your food weaker, while the cold slows down your digestion like a snake in a snowstorm. Leave the cold drinks for well before and well after your meals. This has the added benefit of reducing a potential reliance on antacids. People think that when they have heartburn, it is caused by too much stomach acid. In actuality, it is often the opposite. There is not enough acid in their system to effectively break down the food, so it stays around longer, burning the inner lining. Taking an antacid may temporarily solve the problem, but it will adversely affect digestion, and the problem will continue into the future. If you can eliminate your mealtime cold beverage consumption, along with eliminating antacids, you should see a meaningful benefit to your digestion from a more optimized level of HCl in your stomach. Then, if that doesn't work, look into HCl supplements to get your gut firing on all cylinders. Digestive enzymes. Along with the HCl that breaks down food generally, specific enzymes in the stomach will help with certain types of foods. There are enzymes for fat, dairy, carbs, protein, even the cell walls of vegetables. Having strong digestive enzyme activity that covers these bases is one of the best ways not just to hit a home run with your digestion, but to ensure a longer life as well. A person's lifespan is directly related to the exhaustion of their enzyme potential, says digestive enzyme specialist John Barron. And the use of food enzymes decreases that rate of exhaustion, and thus results in a longer, healthier, and more vital life. The best way to ensure good digestive enzyme activity is by adding digestive enzymes or adding foods that contain natural enzymes like papaya or pineapple. Think of adding enzymes as like swallowing a set of keys, and sometimes a crowbar, to unlock and release the energy from the chains of complex food particles, including protein, fat, cellulose, carbohydrate, dairy, fiber, and anything else you might have ingested. Whereas the HCl melts through everything, specific enzymes will work specifically on these molecules, so good digestion depends on both. Let's speed this up. Good digestion is essential for proper nutrition, but for proper post-dinner sexual activity, sometimes good digestion isn't good enough. Sometimes, whether because of limited time or limited patience, you need to speed things along down the digestive tract. In that situation, ginger is an excellent resource. Ginger has the ability to speed up the time it takes your stomach to pass food to your digestive tract by up to 50%. Add ginger to your meal, and you can say so long to that full feeling in your gut and hello to that full feeling in your pants sooner. Ginger tea works, pickled ginger is great, or just half a thumb of peeled ginger boiled into a tea, or even raw, will do the trick. Good gas, bad gas. Eating a nutritious, delicious, digestible meal that is also good for sex is all about regulating your gas. You don't want any of the fart kind, and you want as much of the nitric oxide kind as you can. There is nothing worse than preparing to have sex when you have a bowel full of gas. It's displeasing to each of the sensory organs that are part of what makes sex so pleasurable. When it's really bad, you can even taste it, which is the death knell of intimacy, and each of us, man and woman alike, has a food that produces farts that can peel paint off a wall. The key to eliminating this kind of gas is simple. Limit fermentable fibers like those found in legumes, Brussels sprouts, and asparagus. Focus on insoluble fiber instead, the kind found in salads and grains like popcorn. If you can do that, you will increase the likelihood that all the explosions during sex come from the front of your body instead of the rear. On the flip side, nitric oxide is like a natural gaseous Viagra. Like a good therapist, nitric oxide tells the tiny muscle cells around the arteries to relax and open up a little bit. When they open up, our blood vessels dilate and we experience more blood flow and circulation. This is coveted by bodybuilders and porn stars alike because it gives you that extra pump, moving the blood fast and furiously to where you direct it. In the bodybuilding classic, Pumping Iron, Arnold Schwarzenegger famously commented that when he gets his pump on in the gym, it feels like he's coming all day. I don't know how I feel about the analogy, but I do know that when you get that nitric oxide flowing and combine it with the anticipation and foreplay prior to sex, all that blood has to go somewhere. Excited yet? Here are some foods with high dietary nitrate levels that are easily converted into the biological signal of nitric oxide. Beets, pumpkin seeds, Swiss chard, arugula, watermelon, red wine, dark chocolate. Eat as many of those as possible with dinner. Don't worry, we've got some recipes coming up. Universal Nutrition Principle Number 9. Cheat like a pro. I never liked the dentist who made you feel guilty for not flossing. As if I didn't already know that the fact I was never going to floss after every meal was less than optimal. I actually feel the same way about sugar. We spent the better part of this book talking massive shit about sugar. Well, guess what? You're still going to eat sugar, whether you know it or not. The responsible thing to do isn't to shame you about it. It's to show you how to do sugar right. Because sometimes you got to dunk the donut, lick the ice cream, and monster the cookie. This doesn't change the earlier plan, of course. You still want to steer clear of the white stuff whenever possible. But sometimes you just gotta indulge. That's the philosophy at the heart of ancient Roman Epicureanism. As a contrast to their Stoic friends, Epicureans set out to create a philosophy surrounding how to maximize their pleasure rather than their effectiveness or accomplishment. What they realized was that constant binging, think hedonism, was detrimental to overall sustained pleasure levels. The pain of the hangover counteracted the pleasure of the bender. So most of the time they would sip small amounts of diluted wine, spend time with their friends, and eat simple foods. But every once in a while they would go ham and get drunk and feast. How to think about sugar. That's a useful way to think about sugar. In general, keep the sugar to less than 5 grams indulgence, but every once in a while give yourself permission to have a bowl of ice cream or eat the carrot cake or get dirty with a good chai and not regret a moment of it. Here are the rules for eating sugar right. 1. Slow it down. As we have discussed ad nauseum to this point, the speed at which sugar is delivered into the body is the crucial factor when it comes to regulating blood sugar and fighting downstream effects like obesity, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. For overall health and optimal mood and physical performance, you need to pair any sugar you consume with something that slows its absorption into the body. And the two things that do that are fat and fiber. That's why having sugar after a high-fat, high-fiber meal is great. 2. Don't add gas to the fire. There is a restaurant on Ka'anapali Beach in Hawaii called Leilani's. For dessert, they have this hula pie, a coconut, whipped cream, and fudge-covered frozen ice cream cake that reminds me of some of the best family vacations of my life. When I go to Leilani's, I'm going to get the hula pie. There's simply no question about that. So I make sure that I cut the carbs entirely from my dinner. No bread, no rice, no sweet potato, nothing. Just protein, fats, and fibers. Because when you add sugar to an already high carbohydrate meal, you are adding fuel to the fire. Which, of course, is exactly what your brain tells you to do after a meal full of carbs to stave off that dreaded blood sugar crash. Get the dessert. It's like prolonging a hangover by continuing to drink. That's how you become a drunk, and getting the dessert after a high-carb meal is how you get fat. 3. Know your timing. I used to take my road bike and ride from somewhere just south of Malibu all the way to the Manhattan Beach Pier. When I got to the pier, after a good 2-hour ride, I could eat whatever I wanted. That is the beauty of a celebratory dinner and a day fully owned. If you have followed the nutritional guidelines thus far and kept sugar and carbs to a minimum, then crushed a good workout, your liver likely has dipped into its glycogen reserve to keep you fueled, just as mine did after my ride down to the pier, and you're free to eat sugar and carbs, pretty much of any type. While a glass of wine after work might have dripped a little back into the tank, topping off your glycogen with some good old starch will help keep your energy tank full with diminished impact on blood sugar levels. 4. Quantity. This should be fairly obvious. You don't need to eat the whole dessert. You don't need to drink the whole bottle of wine. If you have a lot of sugar, your body is going to have no choice but to overcharge your glycogen battery and store fat. 5. Learn your healthy sweeteners. The artificial sweeteners on the market are horrible, often carcinogenic. But the good news is that there are natural alternatives that not only taste better, but have virtually no negative impact on the body. Stevia and monk fruit are foremost among them. Stevia comes from the leaf of a South American plant. It is impossibly sweet, but can carry a bit of a bitter aftertaste if not alchemized with the food or beverage properly. Monk fruit is a great option for confections like chocolate because it can be crystallized like sugar. Native to Southeast Asia, it won't spike your blood sugar and can be used as a substitute for almost all sweeteners. Instead of the slightly bitter stevia finish, it contains a mild menthol finish, so I choose between the two depending on the flavor profile I'm aiming for. 6. Take counteractive measures. You have earned the right to indulge in some delicious carbs with your dinner. You should embrace that and feel zero guilt about it. That does not mean you should not also bring some friends to the sugar party that chill it the fuck out when things start to get a little crazy. If you like ice cream, for example, adding some unusual toppings is a good way to further slow down the absorption process and sometimes even add good nutrients. Everyone screams for ice cream. The first time is when you get it. The second time is after you go hypoglycemic from the insulin dump. That is, if you even have the energy to scream. The good thing about ice cream, though, is that it already has fat, which slows down the process. But if you are clever, you can slow that down even further. For instance, instead of sprinkling more sugar on your ice cream, try sprinkling on some psyllium or chia seeds. One study showed that adding soluble fiber, like what is found in chia and psyllium, dramatically reduced the impact on blood glucose of high-carbohydrate foods. Psyllium has been shown to have a host of benefits on its own, including increased satiety, feeling full. Increased satiety when it comes to ice cream might be the difference between having a scoop and eating the whole pint. With mind-blowing sex on the immediate horizon, the controlled portions are important if you have lactose issues. But if you're into using all the pleasure channels, have psyllium early in the day because it is perhaps best known for epic bowel-clearing poops. Psyllium isn't the only magic powder out there when it comes to digestion at dinner. A couple of other things can lower blood sugar after a meal as well through sheer witchcraft and sorcery. Those things are Ceylon cinnamon and apple cider vinegar. Apple cider vinegar is no one's choice for the next Skittles flavor, but it has a number of great health benefits and no sugar. As little as 1 ounce after a meal has shown benefits in blood sugar management, likely contributing to further studies showing mild weight loss. I use Bragg apple cider vinegar, which comes in convenient 128-ounce bulk bottles, but you can use whatever brand you like. Ideally, it will be organic ACV with the mother, a cute way of saying that it contains part of the probiotic culture that produced it, adding additional support for a healthy gut biome. Add cinnamon, another blood sugar reducer, and you have a great way to combat blood sugar spikes as well. I call that concoction my cheater shooter. To make it, just mix 1 ounce of ACV and half a teaspoon of Ceylon cinnamon into 3 ounces of room temperature water and send it down the hatch. The final measure is something a lot of us do instinctively. Go for a walk. A recent study found that people who got up and went for a walk had lower blood sugar levels and less of a peak in blood sugar than people who didn't get up after eating. One study shows that 15 minutes of low-intensity walking is enough to significantly drop blood sugar levels. How to deal with alcohol. No celebratory dinner is complete without a high-quality cocktail to get you to the table or a glass of great wine to accompany the meal itself. But just like we talked about in the last chapter, the key to alcohol is only having a little. Not necessarily because I'm worried that you will become an alcoholic. It's more because the last thing you want to do is feel like you're owning this day at the expense of the next one. Then you're not really owning the day at all. You're overspending and borrowing from tomorrow. That said, we all make mistakes, so if you find yourself looking at the bottom of a liquor bottle and staring at the prospect of a really tough tomorrow, don't beat yourself up. Just work to beat down the hangover and prepare yourself for some good sleep and a better morning. The ultimate hangover cure. Step 1. Rehydrate. Duh. Alcohol is dehydrating. Along with the loss of water is a loss of minerals. You need both. Drink a liter of natural spring water with the addition of a total of 5 grams of Himalayan salt within the first 2 hours of waking up. Keep drinking water heavily until you pee at least twice. Additional magnesium is also a really good idea before bed, as it further assists with step 2, the reduction of acetaldehyde. Step 2. Reduce the toxic burden of acetaldehyde. Excessive alcohol puts a strain on the body, requiring the utilization of vitamins and minerals to assist with recovery. One of those crucial minerals is molybdenum. Never in the history of TV medical dramas has the mystery ailment been severe molybdenum deficiency. But molybdenum is essential for the body's production of chemicals that neutralize acetaldehyde. What the hell is acetaldehyde? It's one of the main toxins that the body produces as a result of alcohol ingestion. If we have been drinking, we are likely depleting our stores of molybdenum rapidly, increasing our acetaldehyde sensitivity. It's one of the reasons we feel hungover in the morning and why our bodies then begin to crave molybdenum-rich foods like legumes. In Texas, at least, classic hangover food is tacos, nachos, and burritos, all of them chock-full of beans. In the Mediterranean, hummus made from garbanzo beans. Even after a night of crushing Jack Daniels or ouzo, our instincts can be incredibly accurate, cutting across cultures and cuisines. But rather than gorge on nachos, the best idea would be to supplement with some molybdenum, 300 micrograms, prior to bed and again in the morning. Studies have shown it to reduce regular aches and pains, which, if nothing else, will make tomorrow's walk of shame a little easier to endure. Step 3. Balance your neurotransmitters. Alcohol is a gamma-aminobutyric acid, GABA, agonist, meaning that it produces more GABA in the brain. This is what results in the good, loopy feelings from drinking. Another neurotransmitter, glutamate, has the exact opposite effect on GABA. When you drink alcohol, after you are done with the flood of GABA, you experience a glutamate rebound where the body overcorrects for the problem with the release of excess glutamate. This is why you wake up so quickly and sleep so poorly, and it's what leads to the anxious, lightheaded, cracked-out feeling you can get from a hangover. To combat this, you should take things that support the GABA system. This is precisely why the hair of the dog seems to work. At least on a neurotransmitter level, you are getting more GABA in your system to balance out the glutamate. L-theanine, which naturally occurs in green tea, is great at mimicking the effects of GABA. Matcha, as we described in Chapter 6, is the best source. Pro tip: glutathione push. Come Monday morning, a line down the hall at the office leads into a pop-up clinic in our gym that offers glutathione straight into the veins. Glutathione is known as the master antioxidant in the body, and it dismantles all forms of toxicity, including our nemesis acetaldehyde. Glutathione is not only the preferred defense against acetaldehyde, but, as an added benefit, will support the rest of your body in dealing with oxidative stress. The problem is that the stomach neuters glutathione like a brothel keeper from antiquity, so the only way to get it into your body effectively is to absorb a liposomal form through the tissue or inject it into the veins. The latter is undoubtedly the most effective. IV vitamin therapy clinics are gaining in popularity all over the United States. A Google search of your local area with those terms should find you some results. Prescription. Make your new favorite pro-sex dinner. There are two important tasks that lie ahead of you, sex and sleep. These meals are designed to help you with both. It's also finally time for a few carbs. Praise Carrie's, goddess of the grain. Research shows that adding in some carbohydrates after training is good for testosterone. If you are like most of us, it is also good for your sanity and helps you sleep. It's the adult version of cookies and milk. As for sex, these nutrient-dense, digestion-friendly meals are packed with foods that help with the production of nitric oxide. So head over to the Enhancement PDF for all of the recipes, and let's get cooking. Say grace like a scientist. In Ireland, Aldous Huxley's last novel about a utopian island called Pala, Huxley talks about saying grace as an act of gratitude to be done not with words, but with your senses. It's a concept I regularly borrow in my own life, and one that I want you to apply, since it encompasses the principles of modern nutrition science. Before you eat, prepare the very best bite on your fork. Take a moment to look at all the food on your plate. Think about where it came from. A reinforcement to eat food sourced in a healthy manner. Think about the energy required to grow that food, the nutrients, the sunlight, the other plants and animals ingested by your food. take time to bring yourself to a state of mindfulness and reduce stress. Think about how that energy will translate to energy in your own body and what you are going to need that energy for. A reminder about portion control and that you're about to bone down. As you put the bite in your mouth, if the food is lacking in any of these categories, forgive it. You never want to think that what you're about to eat is poison or bad for you or will ruin your diet. Instead, tell your body that what it is about to eat is nourishment. Then look at the food, smell the food, and savor it. When you taste it, chew it until there is nothing left, and your taste buds have flirted with every ingredient in this orgy of flavor. That should be your first bite and how you say grace. It's a piece of mindfulness, a nutrition reinforcer, and a way through the placebo to ensure that your food will be digested and absorbed optimally. Now do it. When any relationship breaks down, it's usually due to lack of communication. This is especially true with our bodies. It sometimes feels like we are speaking two different languages. Our body produces gas or sends a signal that we are hungover. What does that mean? What does our body want? Then conversely, we demand that our body perform the tasks we want. But simultaneously, we might be telling our body that something we ate is poisonous. How does our body respond? If there is one relationship that we all need to repair, it's the one with our body. Here's the way I like to look at it. If we broke our bodies down into the trillions of cells that they are, and imagine those cells as our loyal subjects and our conscious mind as their ruler, what kind of ruler would we be? Most of us would be sadistic tyrants. We feed ourselves things that aren't helpful. We chastise them for the appearance they create. We force them into unnatural positions for long periods of time, and then we take all manner of drugs to shut out what they are trying to communicate with us. We talk to psychiatrists and read books about restoring healthy relationships with our parents, with our friends, with our lovers, but perhaps the most dysfunctional relationship we have is with our bodies. We've got to change that. Our body has our back. Yeah, sometimes it fails. Sometimes it disappoints us. But it tries its hardest always, whether we believe it or not. The key to restoring our relationship with our bodies is the way you maintain any good relationship. You learn and you listen. A lot of this book has been spent explaining what causes some of the signals your body has been sending. So now, when you listen, hopefully you are better at translating that into corrective action. When anything isn't happening the way you want, first ask, what is my body telling me? Pain, inflammation, gas, fatigue, those are all modes of communication. Listen to these messages from the deep. Remember, it is not your body's fault. It always speaks the truth. In the same light, we need to start sending the right messages back to our body. If we want to act like everything is going to be okay, we have to communicate that everything is going to be okay. Not verbally, but emotionally. Emotions are the way we translate our thoughts to the body. It is the Rosetta Stone. So when we have the cake and we smile and we laugh and we celebrate, our body is going to respond better than if we have the cake and tell ourselves what a weak-willed piece of shit we are. If you are going to own your life, you have to take responsibility for all the relationships in it. And there is perhaps none more important than the one with your body. Three pointers. Don't believe everything you have heard about food. First, it was probably wrong. Second, if you believe the bad advice, you will make it feel correct. The mind communicates through the body via your emotions surrounding your choices. Learn to harness the power of belief to your benefit rather than your detriment. Digestion is the foundation of nutrition. It is what delivers the food you eat from your stomach into your cells. To optimize digestion, eat slow, chew hard, and increase levels of HCL and digestive enzymes. For peak sexual prowess with minimal gaseous distraction, eat Prosex foods that contain nitric oxide. If you are going to cheat, do it well. Learn to minimize the cost of an indulgent dessert or a high-carbohydrate meal by timing it after a workout and taking steps to mitigate the ensuing blood sugar spikes, like by taking a walk. If you want to indulge in a few extra adult beverages, add molybdenum-rich foods, hydrate, and boost levels of glutathione. Chapter 13. More, Better Sex. Sex is as important as eating or drinking, and we ought to allow the one appetite to be satisfied with as little restraint or false modesty as the other. Marquis de Sade. You're done with the daily grind, except for a little bump and grind. What day isn't made better by some action with someone you care about, even if that someone is you? People don't have nearly enough sex. No wonder, as a society, we are so frustrated. But we do not only need to have more sex, we need to have better sex. As you'll learn, you may not be able to have one without the other. Getting owned. Look around you. Sex is everywhere. Always has been, always will be. It sells movies, magazines, cars, boats, vacations, beer. Today it even sells cleaning products. In 2017, Mr. Clean ran a Super Bowl ad that showed their iconic bald guy sweeping not just the floors, but the proverbial panties off unsuspecting housewives. There's a reason sex is everywhere. We're never having enough of it. So we crave it, and we jump at every tantalizing suggestion of it, a fact that advertisers and media conglomerates are fully aware of and use to their advantage. Wanting more sex than we normally have is part of the natural order. It's when we start having less sex than we normally should, which we're seeing now, that things really start to go sideways. Statistics show that even millennials, who should be in the prime of their biological sex drive, are having less sex than ever before. That is despite the fact that, at least in theory, sex is just a right swipe away. Those in committed relationships aren't doing any better. The average couple has sex only once or twice per week. A week! The average couple is also a couple of fucking liars. Those self-reported statistics are about as reliable as the number of people who say they love to read and to hike on their dating profiles. Sorry, sport, but the aisles of my local Barnes & Noble are about as empty as the trails at your nearest national park. So how do we explain this paradox? On the one hand, we're a species designed to be obsessed with sex, and it's seemingly more available than ever before. And yet, even with ample demand and accessible supply, we aren't doing enough of it. What gives? As with anything, it's a choice. Sex isn't happening because we are not making it a priority, and there are a lot of reasons why. For one, it might be because the sex we're having is just not that good. In American culture, at least, guys talk about scoring or getting lucky, even with their wives. If men are using this adversarial, zero-sum language to describe sex, it's no wonder women want to have it only when men choose to do something incredibly romantic. You know what all this tells me? The sex isn't very good. Regardless of whose fault it is, it's clear that the sexual expectations of the average woman, who holds the power of sexual choice in the standard relationship, are so low that you gotta play all the games and win both showcase showdowns to make her feel like the price of putting up with suboptimal sex is right. If the sex was usually good, language and behavior like that wouldn't occur as often because everyone would be getting lucky. Both people would win. So why aren't we better at sex? The answer is actually shockingly simple. We've never been taught. As a culture, we are absolutely devoid of any kind of practical sexual education, both for teens and adults. What do we have instead? Well, we usually start with lectures on how dangerous and bad and frightening sex is. Sex ed should be called sex dead, since it's really just a mechanism for adults to convince children that if they have sex outside of marriage or love, there is a 100% chance they or their dreams will die. Jimmy had unprotected sex after prom with a girl he liked, but didn't like it, and the next morning he woke up dead of AIDS. Sally wanted to be an astronaut, but she had sex once in high school, and now she's got 3 kids and gives handjobs for crack. Once we navigate the gauntlet of sex dead, most of us who have parents who are so uncomfortable with the subject of sex that you can literally hear their testicles and ovaries drying up and shrinking back into their stomachs when you ask them about it. At that point, the only options left are cool uncles and porn. They usually come in a set, which is probably how most men learn to have sex. Learning how to have mutually fulfilling sex by watching porn is like learning how to be a great boxer by watching Rocky films. It might be good for motivation, but the technique is wildly exaggerated and the expectations are completely unrealistic. Whatever you're into, it's not going to look like it does in the movies. All of this leads to an unsurprising and troubling problem. All of us are insecure about sex. Is it any wonder why? If we've been told sex is dangerous, and all the sex we have ever seen is porn, and every pop song talks about filling Magnum XL condoms and a juice box that is always wet, how are we supposed to feel about ourselves and sex after the first several times we do it and perform like an amateur at open mic night? If we even manage to find the break in the curtains through all those folds in the fabric, the bright lights might trigger a massive case of stage fright and flop sweat, at which point we're lucky to get one good line out before they're laughing at us instead of with us. Just the thought of it is enough to give you a condition. As a mentor to a lot of young men, I hear from a shocking number of 20-somethings with sexual dysfunction. They are putting so much pressure on themselves to perform that they psych themselves out. Many of them end up just avoiding sex, making excuses to themselves and their lovers. Or they do it in dangerous ways, like by ingesting copious amounts of mysterious gas station boner pills. Just ask former UFC light heavyweight champion John Jones about that. My fiancé, host of the Sex and Relationship docuseries Love Undressed, tells me she, too, hears frequent reports from the ladies of otherwise healthy males failing to achieve and maintain an erection. Stuff like this doesn't happen to any other animal species but humans, because so much of our sexual behavior is about what's going on in the head on top of our shoulders instead of the one inside our pants. I know, because that used to be me. I told you this book would be honest. I have always been hard on myself. In sports, I would replay every missed shot, every mistake 100 times, chastising myself endlessly. But the good thing about sports is that if you make a mistake, you can go practice and fix the problem. With sex, there are no scrimmages, no preseason training, no two-a-days. Every day is game day. So in my early 20s, after a few bad episodes with a girlfriend who made me feel unworthy if I failed to perform to her standards, I was sexually incapacitated. I remember turning down countless sexual advances from women I was interested in simply because the potential pain of failing to perform outweighed the possible pleasure of the sex. It was a truly awful period in my life. But insecurities aren't just for the boys. Women have become insecure about their smell, the shape of their vagina, their vaginal wetness, and even the color of their asshole. A small but important aside, if there is one procedure that is completely absurd, it is getting your asshole bleached. I don't care if it is so dark that it blocks out the sun like the under-eye war paint of an NFL middle linebacker, you don't need to bleach your asshole. This is a prime opportunity to love the skin you're in. Finally, there are the physical things that prevent us from both wanting the sex we need and having the sex we want. On a physical level, our hormones are way out of whack. Everyone has read those now famous studies about how testosterone has dipped in the USA and worldwide. That's just one part of the problem. It's a symptom, not the ultimate cause, of our stilted sex lives. Just as our neurochemistry has been thrown out of whack for sleep and food, we also aren't optimized for sex. We aren't, for example, priming our pumps the way we should for the chemical foundations for arousal, nitric oxide. The result? Our insecurities and insufficiencies continue to get the best of us. We need more sex, and we need better sex. The better the sex we have, the more we'll make it a priority, and that's important. Men who have sex less than once a week have been found to be twice as likely to experience erectile dysfunction. So while this won't be a guide to optimizing your Bumble profile, for anyone who has a partner available now or in the future, this chapter will explain the keys to having more sex and better sex. And in the process, hopefully you'll also rediscover something that is one of the great joys of the human experience. A chance for pleasure, fun, connection, and chemistry that has never been equaled by a drug or a pill or a potion. Owning it. If you have any doubts about what you'll have to do to own it during sex, or if you've reached peak frustration and are ready to just embrace your self-imposed celibacy, think again. Aside from all the self-evident benefits, orgasm feels awesome, sex is also important for our well-being. It relieves stress, stimulates endorphins and hormones, and is crucial for sexual health. Correlations also exist between improved aspects of mental health and immune function. And according to a recent report, frequent sex may help with depression, wound healing, aging, prostate health, and pain tolerance. It's the next best miracle drug after exercise. The reality is, sex and reproduction are at the core of what it means to be human. To incentivize it, to make sure we do it and propagate the species, is it any wonder that we've evolved so that sex makes our bodies and our minds feel so great? We're designed to do the deed, to like the deed. Now we just have to rediscover the desire to do more of it and do it better. More sex. More sex is something that everyone can get behind or on top of or underneath, regardless of age, gender, or sexual orientation. When couples are asked why they don't have more sex, often you'll hear them say they don't have the time. I call bullshit. If you want to have sex, you will find the time. And as for the right time, there is no shortage of books with tips and strategies for the best time to have sex. Yet all of them boil down to one essential reality. It depends on who you are. For most of us, though, the best time to have sex is going to be the most convenient time, which is usually after dinner. And why this chapter sits where it does in the book. The kids will be off to bed, your guests will have gone home, and you'll have the benefits of a post-dinner testosterone spike courtesy of the pro-sex meal you prepared. Then, once you do whatever self-care you need to feel clean and confident and sexy, we'll talk more about self-care in the next chapter, you'll be ready to get after it. The real way to ensure regular visits to Pound Town is to optimize your physical and mental states of readiness. That means managing both your hormones and a phenomenon known as hedonic tolerance. Hormones drive the sex machine. The drive to have sex is largely regulated by our hormones, particularly testosterone and estrogen. While a bit of an oversimplification, think of testosterone like the gas and estrogen like the brakes. Too much gas, you might drive right off a cliff. Too much brakes, you won't get anywhere. Interestingly, this applies both to men and women, regardless of the fact that we each have an abundance of one hormone over the other. And it is finding the right balance that becomes the essential thing for getting where you want to go, as fast and as often as you want to get there. Caveat. About the pill. Because testosterone is so often in the headlines, we tend to think men have an easier time controlling these hormones than women do. But actually, it's the reverse. For women, there is a more direct and ubiquitous form of hormone manipulation. It's called the birth control pill. According to the CDC, 28% of all women using contraception are using the pill. That's well over 10 million women in the United States alone. The pill works by creating a hormonal environment that mimics pregnancy, thus preventing ovulation or the release of the egg. When taken correctly, it is over 99% effective in preventing pregnancy and 100% effective in convincing guys that they can finally throw away their condoms and bareback it. Needless to say, when the hormone-based birth control pill was invented, men and women rejoiced. As they should have, when you consider its many benefits. There is just this one thing. Changing the hormone balance in the female body mimics what happens with low testosterone in men. Adding estrogen and progestin to the body in pill form often leads to reduced sex drive, and according to a recently published study tracking 1 million Danish women, even depression. And to make matters worse, another study showed that women who were on the pill were attracted to partners with similar immune traits and repelled by those who were different, which is the exact opposite of what should happen with a hormonally balanced, normally functioning attraction system. So Jane meets Tommy while she is on the pill, and she is passionately attracted to him. Jane and Tommy get married, and Jane gets off the pill. All of a sudden, her body is screaming no because she is less sexually attracted to him on multiple levels. The pill not only scrambled her hormones, but tricked her into choosing a biological mismatch as well. While I'm not saying the pill should be taken off the table as a birth control option, every woman should go into it knowing the potential hormonal downside and pay attention to how her body responds, especially if sex is important to her. Like so many of the tweaks we need to make to optimize our functioning and own our days, finding hormone balance is easier said than done at first because it is a moving target. Testosterone, for example, decreases naturally with age, and estrogen levels can easily spike due to diet choices, exposure to pollutants like BPA found in plastic water bottles, too much stress, and even carrying excess body weight. The combination can leave even the sturdiest and most robust of people sexually inert. Fortunately, there are numerous ways to naturally boost testosterone and hit the gas so your sex machine gets going again. Here are three. Eat fat. To synthesize hormones like testosterone, the body requires adequate production of saturated fat and cholesterol. The connection between the two is so strong that one study showed that you can get testosterone levels to drop with a low-fat diet and bounce back on a high-fat diet. We should have hammered this point home by now, but just in case you need to hear it a different way, here you go. Eating healthy fats won't make you chubby, but it will definitely help you get one. Get sleep. Sleep is the time when the testosterone factory is open for business. The restorative sleep cycles are when the body can prioritize things like necessary hormone production. Research even shows that every additional hour of sleep you get bumps up testosterone levels 15% or more, while those who experience sleep disturbances tend to have curbed testosterone production. Lift heavy. When training under anaerobic conditions such as lifting heavy weights or sprinting, you are signaling to the body that you are the type of animal that needs to produce testosterone to flourish. Even inexperienced lifters whose bodies are used to the stress loads they endure, their testosterone increases with heavy lifting. So don't skip out on leg day if you want to boost T production, because larger muscles contribute to higher testosterone. Hedonic tolerance and the spanking monkey. The sex experts agree. Masturbation is healthy, and we all do it. It provides a lot of the same benefits as sex, and it's available on demand, like Netflix. And like anything, including Netflix, it is possible to take something healthy and go overboard, to go from hormetic to toxic in the blink of an eye or the push of a button. Scientist turned consciousness explorer John Lilly discovered this for himself when he gave a rhesus monkey access to an orgasm button. He inserted wired catheters into the orgasm center of the monkey's brain, rigged a button that would neurologically trigger an orgasm, and handed him the controls. What he soon found was that over the course of a typical day, sexually curious George would spend 16 hours straight pressing the orgasm button and 8 hours sleeping. The monkey took breaks to eat, too, but only briefly and only enough to sustain himself. Lily had basically discovered how to turn a rhesus monkey into a 14-year-old human boy. While orgasm is definitely a signature of a life well-lived, if we spend